Today is Tuesday, October 4th, 2022. This is part two of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Alan spells his name A-L-L-E-N-M-A-L-M-Q-U-I-S-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Alan. How are you today?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Glad to hear it.
Beautiful days out here in Alabama. It's just perfect.
Oh, lovely. Lovely.
It's just a great time of the year.
We've had some rain. We've had some rain here in Flagstaff, and a very nice day.
Good.
Alan, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. Alan, you talked quite a bit last time about a trip to Sweden and Norway and how you became ill in St. Petersburg, Leningrad. You also mentioned the Sierra Club. And I wondered if you could tell me where you first heard about the club and how you got involved.
Okay. And of course, the Sierra Club was in the headquarters in downtown San Francisco.
Okay.
And that's where I would go regularly, take the train from Los Altos up to San Francisco with my grandmother. And I had heard of, it was mentioned in the Sierra Club was well known in the San Francisco Bay Area, but not much else out in the country yet. And when I was at Stanford, some friends just, and it would have been either 61 or 1962, I said that, oh, the Sierra Club's having a neat activity over in Palo Alto where they were going to demonstrate and teach rappelling off a cliff.
Okay.
And they invited everybody to come, and some of my friends were going, and so I had never done that, so I went along. And I was, you know, it made sense to me how to do it and what was happening. And I rappelled off the cliff that may have been like 40 feet down into the creek bed that they were set up along, and quite enjoyed the day. And they talked about their other activities coming, and, you know, they sponsored hikes mainly in the Sierra. It was literally the Sierra Club, because they were the only group really encouraging people to learn how to backpack, do it correctly and safely. And they sponsored hikes almost every weekend during the spring and summer and fall, at least around on the peninsula of San Francisco area, or the better ones were trips up into the High Sierra, just weekend overnight trips. And I actually went on a couple of those up into the Sierra, and just got a better view of, or a different view of, approaching the wilderness. My family, my father and a friend and their son that was my age and we would go up to Yosemite for several years, and every year we'd have the men would have a hike and an overnight or two nights hike into the wilderness in Yosemite. And I really liked that. I was very, if anything, I knew I was a hiker and it was going to be part of my experience. But this was back before hiking, backpacking was even, you know, a sport, an activity.
Right.
And it was quite very much on the a lot of education going on of how people should behave in the wilderness, how fun it was to hike in the wilderness. This was not to be an ordeal. And if I can digress a little, one of the events, and I must have been early high school, maybe late middle school, on our trip to the Palmy Meadows up there, they had ranger hikes, guided hikes, that I always went on every day.
Right.
And they had ranger programs in the campground around the campfire, real campfire. And there was one that I still remember vividly, was the ranger was talking about hiking and about what you need to do. And then from the sideline out of the dark comes this other ranger, but he was dressed as a hiker. And he had this huge, however he got, probably 60, 70 pounds pack on his back of every way not to go into the wilderness.
Oh, neat. Like what?
And he kind of collapsed by the fire, and the other first ranger welcomed him and said, you know, what have you got? It got around to, well, what are you carrying? What's there? And, of course, he had cast iron fry pan, big can goods, and camp cots. And
oh, my gosh.
And he took it out one at a time out of this huge canvas bag that was somehow strapped on his back. And it made the point so well. And, of course, the audience was in hysterics.
Right.
The whole thing, waiting to see what outrageous thing he'd have next. And it made the education part of it very... I never forgot that.
Nice.
How effective it was, how much I enjoyed it, and how much I learned from that kind of thing. So when I get back to the story that,
you know,
I was definitely into the backpacking and into the Sierra Club as a outing. It was a hiking club.
Can you, Alan, I wanted to ask you, there was a really strong outings group, climbing, caving, out of Berkeley, UC Berkeley. And at that time, there was a gentleman named Phil Pennington there at UC Berkeley. Does that name ring a bell?
No. And I won't be trite, but it was just the fact that the known important things in the world that I grew up and at that time, going to Stanford, it was nothing of importance really existed east of the San Francisco Bay.
Okay.
Meaning nobody. If you mentioned anything about Cal Berkeley, it had to be with some sarcastic remark. But
okay,
no, I don't. And that's the first I've heard of a hiking group at Berkeley, because at this time there was none at Stanford, no organized club or anything. It was just guys that you'd meet and words would get around, and now that I think of it, there was nothing at Stanford, so I don't know about
that. Okay, no worries.
Berkeley.
And then
that's just interesting.
Thinking about some other people in the club at that time, certainly David Brower.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to remember who else might have been in the club that you might have met that would be formative for you. Can you think of any other names of people?
Not really.
Okay.
Because I figured out 63 in the spring is when I organized things and headed to Arizona. The goal was to go to the Grand Canyon and photograph and hike and just find out what I could do and if I liked it and if it was successful. And I didn't have that much at that point, but when I got the group of pictures and all, then it got more involved in it. So we're talking a couple of years ahead.
Okay.
After my Army experiences in the North Rim. And then there were articles in the Sierra Club Bulletin that somehow with friends or all, they found out that I had the pictures of the wilderness and the Grand Canyon and hiking and contacted me. And I don't remember who did it, but
okay, well let's go back then. Let's go back to your first introduction. I was thinking of your first introduction to the Sierra Club. You went on an outing, did some rappelling. Then did you actually go with, it sounds like you went with the club on some hiking up in Yosemite, up in the Sierras.
In the Sierras.
How did you get the idea that you wanted to do some hiking in Grand Canyon by yourself?
Well, that's... family wondered that too. It just happened.
Okay.
Well, you asked about, you know, the trip to Sweden and Norway. I went there and I initially was staying with family friends north of Stockholm and taking day trips. And I had my grandmother had bought an organized tour for me to go up into northern Sweden by train. It was a week's trip that went up above the Arctic Circle, and you know, I was basically on my own there. I came back and I had another trip to the southwest from Stockholm on a canal boat that was 3 days and nights. And then I got the idea, I don't know why, I just liked the idea of seeing the fjords in Norway. So I took off on my own for, turned out, about 3 weeks of just traveling slowly from place to place around the end of Norway and going up, and made it about halfway up on that side, going into the fjords, all on public transportation. They have these really great mail buses, they called it, and staying in pensions. The people rented bed and breakfast, really, and then going on the fjords on the ferry boats. I found out that I could see everything that cruise ships were seeing by just, you know, making a point of where I went on. And I just carried this big, thick, like, phone book that had all the ferry schedules and all the bus schedules.
Ooh.
And I had the, and you could buy a pass for a week, and you'd just show your pass and go anywhere you wanted in the country. And,
nice.
And I would just go that way. And I, you know, I loved the country, and I found out that I could really function by myself and enjoyed being by myself.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I then came back, and like I mentioned last time, went to Russia on a tour, and that was kind of a disaster because I got really, really sick.
Right.
But, and then when I came back, I to get out to convince them to let me out of the hospital, I after 3 weeks, I told them, you know, that the friends I was staying with, their son was a doctor in Sweden, and I, you know, I'd check in with him and do what he said for the next couple of weeks, and I did, but I found out I wasn't in physical shape to go anywhere. I could barely walk. And so after a couple of weeks there, then I had the idea of I really wanted to go to Switzerland and see the Alps and the glaciers. And so I just took off, and I had a Eurail pass, which, you know, was a pass where for a month I had, so I could go on any railroad anywhere in Switzerland.
Nice.
And I and did, and I just traveled around seeing all the sites, ending up in all the places I could get up in the high Alps and get up on the glaciers.
Okay.
And just, you know, I'd stay in like a bed and breakfast where I had a private room and a bathroom down the hall and a beautiful, huge breakfast in the morning. And I just found that that works very well for me. I was just very happy by myself. I could meet people out on other tourists, out on the day hikes and all if I wanted, but I didn't mind. I was just happy by myself. So
did you have your, did you have a camera with you at that time?
Yes, I had a, you know, my 35mm single lens reflex, pretty low end compared to what was available in later years.
Okay.
But it was a 35mm camera. You know, it was the excuse. I really enjoyed taking the pictures and studying it and thinking about it and, you know, determining what was, what made a certain picture good and another one not any good. And, and did that, that was really what I did all day, was to take pictures. Some days I only took two or three, but that's the way it goes. I just enjoyed the traveling and by myself, and that, then the next few years, I took that to an extreme in the Grand Canyon for weeks and weeks by myself.
But it does make perfect sense.
Yeah.
How that came to pass, how you came to the Grand Canyon alone.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then how did you choose the Grand Canyon versus, you know, Joshua Tree or Bryce or Zion or some other location in the West? Could have been Yellowstone.
I really don't remember why it was those, any specific thing. It just seemed great to me, and the challenge of, I know I really strongly felt the challenge of going out in the desert like it is in the canyon in the summer and doing it right. You know, how do you survive in the desert?
Right.
And I remember at Stanford, I'd go up in the library and they had historic books on, especially Saudi Arabia and Egypt, and it was basically, I found the ones that was, you know, people that were, they were explorers back then in the 1890s and 1900s, but how did they exist back there? Because they survived, you know, they didn't. And some of them by themselves, you know,
okay.
There are several explorers that went through the Holy Land and Arabia and Jordan and in the earliest days and were by themselves and very articulate. I was never that articulate, but I appreciated. And I learned very consciously on what you had to do to survive in the desert.
Okay.
And oddly enough, I also found that when I started studying the animals of the desert, things like the rabbits and cottontails and coyotes and even lizards and all, you know, how did they survive out there? And it had real, important lessons for me personally.
Hmm.
You know, like, how does a cottontail live out in the desert basically with no water?
Right.
You know, and so I was really into that, and I don't know, the family of my parents and I had a, I think I mentioned it before, a grand tour of the West. We went by Grand or Death Valley, Zion. I don't remember the North Rim, but we went to Bryce and then went north to Teton, Yellowstone, Glacier, and all those parks, and swung around and came down the coast. That was just such a marvelous experience for me. And then I knew that I was sure that we had not been to the Grand Canyon.
Okay.
And the other fact was the Sierra Club was really, I guess, beating the drums about, you know, the Grand Canyon's in peril of being destroyed. And I remember when the original article came out in Reader's Digest about, you know, as it was the first national publication of more dams in the Grand Canyon and flooding it. And I knew that upset me. I knew there was a lot of turmoil there. And I just wanted to see it for myself. And that's probably why I ended up at the Grand Canyon.
Was that 1963?
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, the various, what happened in what sequence, but it was all melded together. It had ended up as to why I was there.
Right. And Alan, can you take us through sort of item by item? What did you pack? What did you bring? What kind of pack did you have? What kind of footwear did you have? Did you have a hat? What kind of clothing? What did you have?
I planned for that because it was very interesting, I think, in the end. First, I left Los Altos Hills there. I had bought a car, and it was an old 50s Ford Fairlane sedan.
Okay.
It wasn't fancy. It had no chrome on it. It ran, and I filled up the back with my dad's old umbrella tent, and I had a darkroom tent, a little pup tent that I was going to use as a darkroom. And I ended up driving that Fairlane on what is now a pretty rough four-wheel drive road. And all across the plateaus out there worked for me. But I went to Death Valley first. I went up in the Panamint Mountains because I was trying to think if it was June or May that I left. So the bottom of Death Valley was pretty hot already. So I went up in the Panamint Mountains and camped and hiked Telescope Peak and back.
Nice.
I went across the valley, got a couple good pictures there with the 8x10, and then went to Mount Charleston, which is north of Las Vegas.
Right.
And went up there and camped at the High Pines because it was too hot down below. And I hiked Mount Charleston, which was really fabulous. My first big exposure to bristlecone pines.
Oh, nice.
Up above tree line. And I then I'll mention one thing only because it was the way things happened back then. I had told my parents that I, you know, was going to, an idea just for what direction I was going, and that they could forward to me any mail that I got. And I, the first forwarding address I gave them was Boulder City, Nevada.
Okay.
Over, you know, beside Hoover Dam.
Yeah.
And I, unfortunately, when I got to Lake Mead there to camp, it was like 112.
Ooh.
And there was, I came in on like a Saturday and there was no mail for me. And meant I had to spend the weekend there at Boulder Beach in the heat. And then, and just laying in Lake Mead. But then I would go into Boulder City to the post office on Monday. And I think I had to wait and go in on Tuesday till my package of mail was arrived. It wasn't anything interesting, but at least I got it.
And okay.
That's my parents' postcard. But that's the way I went for the next couple of months was, you know, please send my mail to such and such a post office and I'll pick it up. But I then went on to the South Rim and camped. And the way I started doing the hiking was first I just hiked down, that would be the Bright Angel Trail to Indian Gardens and down to Phantom Ranch for an overnight backpack with just the minimal, no cameras, just I had to sleep on an air mattress because I really can't stand sleeping on the ground.
Okay.
Just a sheet to crawl into, and
mm-hmm.
I checked out the, you know, and decided, well, I can do this, and I went back up on the north-south rim. And then I got the what became my normal backpacking was I had made a wooden box to go on that I attached to an aluminum backpack frame.
Okay.
And these backpack frames, you had to get it from REI in Seattle. They were not sold in sporting goods stores, so there were just none available. You got a little kind of a mimeographed catalog from REI and what they had, and they were basically putting them together there, welding the aluminum at the REI place.
Oh, wow.
And then, well, I can mention that a friend of mine that we went hiking in the Sierra when I was still in school. He was from New York, and he carried everything in a Algonquin, wooden flats, woven basket that
went
on his back. And I didn't really want that, so I had a, made my own back thing.
Was that the box you were talking about?
Yeah, the box that I made that bolted onto the backpack.
Okay.
And in the box, I had the camera, two film holders, and a box of sheets, maybe 10 sheets of film. And then I had the... I really like to sleep in a little pup tent, so I had a one-man pup tent that I always carried, and I had a light air mattress, like I said. I didn't carry any stones. No one carried camp stones. I always would gather some sticks and make a tiny fire to heat the food.
What did you use for a pot?
Okay, I carried a little aluminum pot about 2 inches high and 6 inches around.
Okay.
And the other thing all the early hiking was, one of the goals was trying to work out these bizarre freeze-dried foods that were being experimented with.
Okay.
And for a couple of years, it was horrible stuff.
Ooh.
And I found that I could get some macaroni or and cheese, and then have some meat. And what I would do was, I found it was really important to have some real meat along if you're going to be out for a couple of weeks, on several trips. But it meant that I was basically, what I was eating on the trail was what the majority of my diet. And so I hate to mention it, but I'm a true Spam addicted to it. I love Spam.
Okay.
I loved it back then, and I knew why. It was because it was the protein, and it was half fat. And when you're out exercising day in and day out, you need those two things. It's simple to get lots of carbs.
Right.
But you've got to have the real protein.
Mm.
And it turned out that it was feasible to take either a little can of tuna fish or a Spam, where I'd eat it, for dinner, and pack it kind of inside the tent there, where it survived without refrigeration till the next morning, and eat the other half of the can the next morning.
Mm-hmm.
And, or put it into a creek if something was available. The other thing that I developed is that flashlights just were too big and didn't last long at all, and it was carrying a lot of weight for nothing. But I found that I could get I took two or three stubby candles with me always. And at night, after dinner, and it'd get dark, and I'd get in the little pup tent, and I always brought something to read. or just a novel or something that I just tear off the cover and have something to read and by the candlelight. And the other thing I found that, people ask how did you survive by yourself always? Well, I found that the radio station, the big NBC station in Albuquerque, the KNBC, or I guess it was or something like that, clear channel. Well, in the evening and all night, I could get a clear signal of that radio station on a tiny little transistor radio. It was worthless during the day, unless you had a direct line to a radio antenna. But at night, I could pick up Albuquerque and even San Francisco and any of these big, high, powerful stations.
Right.
And I'd listen to the news, and I'd listen to the discussions, or just have the music in the background.
Nice.
But I found that I functioned really well with that, of having, and that's just psychologically. Some people go out in the wilderness and sleep on the ground and wouldn't have anything else along, but they have usually in groups that people can talk and share, but I didn't have that, so I found I functioned really well with the little radio, which was even smaller than a deck of cards.
Oh, nice. Yeah, very small.
And it's amazing that it would just come in so clearly.
And what did you do for canteens, and what did you do for footwear?
Okay, footwear, I had hiking boots, but I don't remember not having hiking boots with, like, Vibram soles on them.
Okay.
The first couple pair may have been just leather work boots, but they were similar to that, and I think I, got the first true hiking boots with Vibram or whatever the brand was initially, but that's what I always remember hiking in. Canteen, yeah, there were no plastic bottles back then.
Right.
And I had the old-fashioned tin canteen that was circular and flat on both sides and had a lid at the top that unscrewed, and it had a strap that you could put over your shoulder or over the pack. And some trips I'd take two of those. Some I would just manage if I knew there was water where I was going.
Yep.
And carry them. But that was the key. That's what I carried.
Those were half gallon canteens or gallon?
Oh, that'd be half gallon.
Half gallon, okay.
Yeah, I was definitely on the border of not having enough water.
Mm-hmm. But, a gallon will get you down there. And
Yeah.
So this is 1963. I don't think there was a permit system in place. Could just go.
You could just go. There was a hiking backcountry. What's now the backcountry office was just an office over in the headquarters in the ranger station. There was just a contact. And what they had, and I still have it somewhere, was a little booklet that they had mimeographed in the office there on Grand Canyon hike.
Okay.
And it was folded up, so it ended up being like 4x6 6 inches, this little thing that it just lifted the trails by name, and most of them were unmaintained, very difficult. Do not attempt this year, not experienced, you know. And the only trails were the Bright Angel and North and South Kayabat that were actually recommended to the public. Another thing along with this, I found out, and what worked for me was on the way down, I would cache at least two, and I don't, as it was water, two bottles of water somehow, but I don't know what I was using for containers then, but definitely a good 16-ounce can of fruit cocktails.
Okay.
And then when I came out, when I hiked out of Santa Branch and all, I'd leave as soon as the sun set, and I would basically hike out all night and hike up to, it was just a great motivator to get to that can of food cocktail. It was solid sugar, you know, and it was water.
Yeah.
It was 16 ounces of water, really. And I, the other thing I found, though, that I had to have a real flashlight. So, and one that had, the minimum would be 2 D cells in it. But I think that's all I used. But the way I'd come out is I'd come to a switchback and I'd turn on the flashlight and look up the trail for the next switchback, making sure there were no local, two things, no snakes and no hikers passed out on the trail.
Right.
And then I'd turn it off and I'd walk up to that switchback. I'd turn, I'd show the flashlight up the trail and turn it off and walk up there. And it's probably, at least 4, maybe 5 times, even more than that. But I think of 5 times there off the South Rim Village that I came out that way. And it worked very well for me. Cash was always there, but there was very, very little hiking down there. But, to me, it was all planning ahead because I knew that I was pushing my limits because it was darn hot. The first trip, I just hiked down to Phantom Ranch and back, I'd mentioned, without any camera gear, and then packed the camera and the stuff for a week and went down the South Kayabab, spent a night at Phantom Ranch, and then hiked around to Clear Creek, got up at dawn, and got around there before it was over 100.
Right.
And spent 2 nights there and really enjoyed that. Got a good picture I still enjoy from that Clear Creek. Right. And then I hiked back to Phantom Ranch and then hiked out the South Kayabab because that was more direct than.
Yes.
And off. The, one humorous thing I've told the story many, many times was on one of these trips, I one of the first ones when I was coming out from Anna Ranch up to the rim, and I had hiked and napped all night and was up the last couple hundred yards up to the rim there, and meeting lots of day hikers coming down.
Right.
And there was one man and lady who definitely belonged on the golf course, not the trail. You know, she was had a, I remember vividly, a white sun dress and white pumps. And as I went by, they kind of got off the trail as best they could, but I sighted up there. And the woman said to her husband, my goodness, hiking is a dirty sport. And I thought, thank you, lady. That I appreciate that, and that's what I feel like, and that to me is a badge of, you know, honor to come out of the canyon covered in dirt and sweat, and backpack and a smile on my face.
Mm-hmm.
Is like what it's all about.
So in 63, the swimming pool was there at Phantom Ranch.
I was going to mention that. There were two very important factors. Number one, there was nobody in the campground.
Okay.
And number two,
oh,
there was the swimming pool.
So
and
this
I
was
loved that swimming pool.
This was the middle of summer. There would be definitely less people there because spring and fall, those numbers go up. Winter, they drop off again. Okay.
That was one of the things I liked. I was beginning to like the idea of going by myself, and the fact that the campground down there was almost empty appealed to me. I wasn't distressed, but the pool, I was so upset when the park had to close the pool.
Yeah.
You know.
But the ranch would have been quiet as well for guests, and so jumping in the pool would have been easy.
Oh, yeah. Well, they welcomed hikers in the pool.
Okay.
In fact, they assumed that was part of the, making sure there weren't people needing rescue because you came down there and immediately went up and got in the pool. And then everything was right.
It was right with the world. Yeah. Yeah. And
because you've been down there into the inner gorge. When you drop in the inner gorge, it's like opening an oven door.
Yeah, it's oven hot. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you eat down at the Phantom Ranch canteen? Did you buy any food down there?
I don't think so. I don't remember it.
Okay.
Because I could have gotten, you know, a snack, or I didn't really sit down for food because I had my own.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably got a candy bar or a soda pop or something like that, and would just, you know, felt like I had to spend some money for them to keep that wonderful pool going.
Did you, on those early hikes, did you make friends with anyone down at Phantom, either the people working at the ranch or the USGS stage gauge operator?
No.
Okay.
Friendly in there. That would be, I'm sure there was a Park Service person who'd come through. And
right.
I know it was. Actually, this was so early in the history of Phantom Ranch that they didn't have any, you know, special places to put your food in the campground.
Okay.
The animals out. And I think about it, there were no squirrels and animals. It was just later years that became so, you know, difficult really taking care of your food because there were lots of creatures out there ready to get it.
Right. So, Alan, I'm trying to wrap my head around this. You've got an aluminum frame pack, which is pretty light, but then you've got a box on it, and I'm assuming that that box was probably quarter inch plywood.
Well,
and there's a pup tent. There's an air mattress. There's cans of food. There's a gallon of water, maybe 2 half gallons, or maybe one. Things are starting to build up there weight wise. What do you think your pack weight was?
I always said 50 pounds, and I think I must have weighed it once or twice to get that much for, going out for a week. And that's just a number that I can't really swear by, but it was, that makes sense to me. That's what I remember.
Okay.
It was really hard for me to pick up the pack. I'd have to put it up on a ledge and then back into it and put it on. And I just moved slowly and carefully. I knew I could not stumble or fall down. And I just would start early and have a reasonable length to go.
Yeah. And I didn't ask you at this time. Let's see. I'm just kind of working out the math. You were born in 1941, 51, 61. So you would have been 22.
Right.
And how tall were you, and how much did you weigh?
Well, I was 6'2 and about 155.
Okay.
Tall and skinny was the word.
Okay. So managing a 50-pound pack, that's a third of your body weight. That's not unreasonable.
Right.
It's not easy, but it's not unreasonable. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then, I tried to get somewhere and then have a layover day when I could explore and photograph and not have the extra gear, though I was carrying that camera around.
So nice.
It wasn't much of a release. And then the interesting part, well, by coincidence, but I actually went on purpose. My next plan was to go to Havasu.
Okay.
And I did that, and I went down there, backpacked in, and with all my gear and food and camped below the falls, and there were very few people there.
This was in the summer of 63.
Yeah. And, there was nothing at Havasu Village but a village.
Okay.
Very dusty. There was no hotel. No. There was a little convenience store that for the Indians that we could get something. And I think I did buy a couple canned goods. But, and there was a tribal office there. And I don't know if it was a federal sheriff or marshal or sheriff who was there. When I got the little handout mimeograph sheet from the park, it said you have to stop and pay your fee at the village there. And he said, just be patient because there may not be anybody there, but they'll show up eventually.
Okay.
Just sit on the porch and take it easy. And that's what it was. But it was, only 20 minutes or so. Somebody came by and got my money. And I spent, I think, 3 nights down there at least. And really, that place was just magical. days, and I came out of it with one very, very special picture down below the falls that just gives mean, you know, the whole idea of the canyon, the falls, the cascades over those big travertine dams. Just an exciting place to be. And later years, my wife and another couple hiked in there, and it was still just as great. But there were no restrictions when I was there first. And a few people were packed down on the mule with their, and mainly their gear was packed down and they hiked in.
Right.
So there were maybe 10 or 15 others in the canyon there at the campground.
So at this time, the Park Service ran the campground. The tribe's boundaries were minuscule there. It was just the village of Supai, and that was it. And the park was all around them.
Right.
And then so there was a campground, and a ranger station was there?
No, I don't remember a ranger station. I don't remember ever seeing a Park Service person.
Okay.
There was a, and kind of what you could pretend was the main street, but it was just a dirt path with horses and mules going up and down it.
Right. No, this would be down at the campground. There might have been a tiny little building for a ranger. But that might have been in the 70s as well, before the Enlargement Act.
One when I was there.
Okay. Okay.
At all.
And then did you go down through the chain route, the cool tubes, down to the bottom of Mooney Fall? And then did you hike down to the river?
I hauled all my gear down there.
Oh, wow.
But I only went about another 2 miles and found this site where there was a minor fall. Well, it's not really a waterfall, but it came down maybe 2 or 3 feet. And there was several of these travertine pools, and the dams looked really well. And I spent a lot of time photographing there and then went back up. That was as far as I went that trip.
Okay.
Later years, I was down the river and went about 2 or 3 miles up the canyon, but never been through the whole thing.
Okay, all right. And I had a question about taking pictures. I don't know how an 8x10 works, and you mentioned that you had film holders, a couple of those. How did you load, once you'd exposed the negative to the image you wanted to capture, how did you set up your pup tent and crawl in there? What did you do to make a dark room?
I'll explain that because the camera, you know, it's a big wooden box with a glass, a frosted glass on the back where you can see the image coming through the lens. The lens, it's a track. And it has a bellows that moves the lens in and out so you can focus exactly.
Okay.
But during the daytime, you can't see the image on the frosted glass, so you have this black piece of material.
Oh, gosh.
And I had as light of one as I could get. maybe 3 by 4 feet, but you put that over your head and over the camera.
In the summertime.
Then you could.
In the heat.
Yeah, in the summertime, in the heat. That's another thing. I debated whether to put a white one over it, but I decided, no, that would be adding too much.
So
it worked. And then the image, of course, is upside down.
Okay.
That you're looking at. And there are knobs you can turn that lift the film end of the camera up and down and tilt it forward and back. And the lens can be tilted forward and back. And you can get an amazing depth of field where you can get a picture with rocks or flowers right in front of you a foot away, and you can see the cliff or mountains way in the distance, all in perfect clarity and focus.
Wow.
And then I had two film holders, and they were, I guess they were wooden and some plastic later in metal, but it was each film holder held two sheets of film, and they had to be loaded in the dark.
Okay.
And you'd pull out the slide, or you opened up the end of it, and you slid it in the groove and closed it up. And just for weight matters, I would take two of these film holders. So I have four negatives potential every day. And then I would have a box. The film came in. I got boxes of 10. And the film, so I might have six additional sheets in there. And that, those boxes were cardboard boxes. There were three boxes, one inside the other, that kept the film from exposing.
Okay.
And then at night, I either, if I had the tip was good for, I could have real easy to do it, but I could just, if it was a pretty dark night, get it in the, I didn't have a sleeping bag, so it was just any way I could cover up and keep the film from being exposed, even to starlight. So I would take the sheets that I had exposed that day, maybe one or two, but I'd take them out and I'd stack them in the bottom of the film box and replace them with two new ones.
Right.
And then when I got out, I would at some point process the film.
Right there with all the equipment you had in your car.
Yeah. I had a little pup tent, a little bigger pup tent, because I could actually fit in it. And I had painted it black, and I had painted the other side white on the outside, and it really held the light well at night. It was very dark, and I just had to camp at a place with water.
Okay.
And one of the times later in this trip, I camped down on Oak Creek below Flagstaff.
Yeah.
And right next to the creek, and I would stay up all night processing films, because each negative was processed separately, and the developer, and I'd take it out, and I don't tell anybody, but I'd wash it in the creek.
Okay.
It didn't have many chemicals on it, considering all the pollution that went down that creek. I didn't feel bad about washing some fixer off the negative. I never poured chemicals in the creek.
Right.
That's what I did. And
so was that exciting? I mean, after so many days, you were taking these images, you didn't know what the photographs would look like. And then when you finally developed them, tell me about that.
That was always exciting. I'll say that at the beginning, to my dismay, corners would be blurred out. In other words, light had gotten to it.
Oh.
Just made me much more careful. And I got it down where I could make, I still have the negatives that I did out there that are in perfect shape here 60 years later. And it was always exciting. And the other thing I did, like at the Oak Creek, which was a really good place, I had during the day, and that I could crimp them too, because I, you know, the 8x10, the advantage of it is you end up with an 8x10 print. They're not little 35mm little tiny prints.
Little contact print kind of thing.
You get the whole contact print. And so I had it, and it just takes a print frame, which is a piece of a wooden frame with a piece of glass that you keep clean. You put the negative down on it upside down. You put the piece of paper over it. This is in the dark. And then there's a back side that you clamp in that holds it all tight. And then I just had a, you know, like even a flashlight you could turn on and expose it. I actually got to where I could just expose it for a couple seconds outside, not in the direct sun, but I could get a print that would show me exactly what was going on there and how I could do it better later. But that was worth it to me. And I did that there, and I also did it later over by Santa Fe at Bandelier National Monument. There's a trail, a campground was right by the creek there. And
okay.
Processed film over there.
Nice.
And
okay.
But the part that was really, to me, more interesting, when I was really exploring both back home and years before and getting ready for this trip, it amazed me that it was still basically unsurveyed land. And there were no topo maps and no 15-minute and 7.5-minute topo maps. There was the maps that actually John Wesley Powell made were still published and improved by the USGS, and there were huge areas, the whole eastern and western Grand Canyon, they were just big wall-sized maps. And I had those, and fortunately they put anything that was considered a trail back in the 1890s and turn of the century, which I was interested in.
Okay.
And the one place that was mapped was a special map that the USGS made for the Bureau of Reclamation of the area around Bridge Canyon.
Okay.
And it was very beautifully mapped, and just this blank area around, which really appealed to me. But here I was going in to see places that really hadn't been mapped yet publicly.
Nice.
And see where I lived in Los Altos and school in Palo Alto, the USGS was right half mile away there where they did all the mapping. And the public office there, the sales office, was just fantastic because I could get all the first initial draft copies of the maps as they were made, and I got this Bridge Canyon map.
Nice.
First trip. Later, I got lots of new maps as they were prepared. But there on that map, it showed a trail. It started coming down Birch Canyon, going around on the top of the inner gorge, and then going kind of down a cliff switchbacking to a mining site of some kind, and it came to the river. And I just said, I've got to do that. And so I went around there. I got a permit from the Wallafly. And back then, it was just a little office in town, not a big town there at Peach Springs. And
What year was this? What year was this?
63.
Still in the summer of 63?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I...
Hey, Alan, you know, I'm going to jump in here. We've been happily yik-yakking away for about an hour and 10 minutes here. I'm going to ask you a ton of questions about this hike into Bridge Canyon. And so maybe this is a good time to put a comma here. And,
right.
And we'll pick this up next time.
Right. That'll be good because... Yeah, and this part is interesting on what I found down there and the hikes into the other canyons there. And eventually, you know, that turned out to be the only picture the Sierra Club had of the Grand Canyon at looking down into Bridge Canyon.
Nice.
What it really the Bureau was talking about.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
And they published that in the... Sierra Club bulletin.
All right.
And all of that. So that's next time.
Let's do that. That sounds great. Is there anything else you'd like to add about what we've talked about?
No. We didn't get very far, but that's the way it goes.
That's the way it goes. We got pretty far. You got us all the way down to Phantom Ranch and back. We went to Clear Creek.
Yeah.
We had a good time. Oh, this is good. Okay, well, with that, let's conclude part two of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Today is October 4th, 2022. My name is Tom Martin, and Alan, thank you so very much.
Thank you.